your time. And like I said, you could, as a host, you go ahead and start whenever you feel ready.
Okay, thanks.
Absolutely.
Okay, welcome everyone to the very first episode of Weird Connections, University Edition. This is where curiosity meets conversation, where unexpected connections are made, and where two brilliant minds from the same university cross paths for the very first time, right here on this show. There's no algorithm, no formula, no carefully curated method behind how we select and pair our guests. The beauty of this show is the spontaneity. We're simply bringing together two professors teaching at the same university, the same institution, and yet have never met until now. What will they have in common, and what fascinating discussions will unfold when we set them on a path of discovery, debate, and maybe a bit of friendly disagreement? One thing's for certain, while the structure of Weird Connections University Edition is simple and straightforward, our guests are anything but. Join us as we dive into the minds of scholars, thinkers, and educators. The most interesting conversations often happen in unexpected places. Welcome to Weird Connections University Edition. Let's make history. Well, thank you to my esteemed guests. Both of you are doctors, I understand, PhDs. I have nothing before or after my name, unlike you guys. So I would say, may I call you Tony? May I call you Candace? Or is it Professor Tony, Professor Long?
If we disagree, you can have the doctor.
Like I said, I don't even have anything in front or behind. You have both. Is that okay, Professor Long? May I call you Tony?
Tony.
Professor? Is it Odgers?
Odgers, yeah.
Odgers, yeah. Professor Odgers. May I call you, may we call you Candace?
Of course.
Okay, thank you. Eddie does a show called Exit the Matrix, and I was thinking, how would I introduce if I would say it's like, if I said Eddie has a show on Netflix,
it's very
it's
on YouTube here, it's like a very conspiracy theory based show. I've hosted a couple of other shows in the past as well. I'm a singer songwriter and a composer for film and television. You can find my movies on Amazon Prime, Netflix, Redbox, wherever you guys watch your movies. You can find my stuff. So go check it out. My name is Eddie Booz. I'm glad to be here co-hosting with Ryan on Weird Connections
today.
Thanks
for doing this, Tony. We were going to have some snacks, but we decided to have some drinks. And I thought, I'm sure in the Long household, drinking games are interesting and creative. But the only thing I could come up with was, if I say the word fuck, I'll drink. If either of you say the word right, you drink. And we can always just do a social, so...
Sounds good.
You missed an opportunity right, to drink to A, right?
No.
Any Canadian? No, you won't drink to a Canadian?
You're both Canadian. I'll ask you about that. As we were walking in here, and we talked a little about this, Candace, you're from Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
And I understand that's as far north as you can get in Canada. Is that right?
It's about as cold as you can get anywhere in the world. Yeah. North of North Dakota, so for your viewers.
Okay. Tony, where do you hail from in Canada?
I'm originally from a place called Barrie, which is, I always say, an hour north of Toronto and about 40 years behind.
Okay.
Now, what you mean, you say 40 years behind, you mean like culture-wise, tech-wise? What are we talking here? All of the above. Right.
You know, it's like time slowed down there a little bit at some point.
I like those places.
Yeah.
Life is a little slower paced in those places. I like that.
Well, we're excited to talk to both of you. I personally need a psychologist. I've never spoken with one. And I know Eddie needs a geneticist. Am I saying that correctly? Geneticist?
Yes.
Candace, I'm guessing that a lot of your friends, and I would be in this category, is that if I saw you walking the dog, I would want to throw my whole life story out at you and ask you if what I'm doing is weird or if what I'm doing is right. And I'm guessing with your research into the kids and adolescents, and you get a lot of that.
So you want to know my secrets?
Well, I do.
I was going
to ask you about that, but I was going to say, Tony, do you get the same thing? A lot. Everybody comes up to you and asks you about genetics.
Some people have questions. Yes.
Am I the only one?
Yeah. We sort of usually geneticists will answer most of them as long as it has nothing to do with eternity.
Right. Okay. So and then I had it in my notes was for both of you. Did OJ do it? And we talked a little bit about this. It sounds like Candace, you're not willing to discuss this for whatever
reason.
I'm going
to plead the fifth.
We'll leave you alone. Okay. But Tony, you're free to speak on the OJ case, and considering
we talk a little about it in my intro genetics class because there was DNA evidence in the trial, right? So one of the things that's interesting, especially nowadays about DNA evidence, is that you can get a lot of information about people. So there was strong DNA evidence at the crime scene, so that would be pretty implicating.
Right.
But then there was also, of course, the way the evidence was handled was complex. So so there could have been evidence moved around and things like that. We don't know. We'll never know, right?
Right. Well, I think it's pretty certain the evidence is the evidence, and the DNA matches, and there's no doubting that. There's a recent show just came out, and like I said, I wasn't paying attention to any of this stuff. And I realize it's all about the glove, and it's not that the glove didn't fit or the glove fits when it's acquit, but one glove was at the crime scene and another glove was at his house. That just doesn't add up to me. So if I was going to ask a psychologist that was willing to talk about this case, I would say, isn't there a reasonable doubt that those cops are scumbags and plant did this on purpose and...
Both things could be true,
yes.
Right? So both things could be true. There could have been shady dealings with the evidence, and he could have done it, and the DNA could have been correct.
Then that's what, do you think, agree that that's what got him off, was that there's doubt that the cops were bad? That's the theory I came up with just recently. So anyway.
But there's really one thing happening now that's far more interesting with DNA evidence, where they're taking DNA evidence from old cases and then they're searching it against public databases, and then you can often find in the public databases like a couple of second cousins or first cousins, and then they have people that are looking at the genealogies and then narrowing down the suspects quite a bit.
So
and
do 21andMe or no? This is a big debate in our family.
Cases.
Interesting.
I refuse to do 21andMe.
But the point, what's interesting about it is that once there's enough second or third degree relatives that are in the database, it doesn't even matter if you do it or not. That's the other thing we talk about in intro genetics now that's really interesting in terms of, a thing we should talk about as a society.
Well, I should probably introduce the guests. Candace Odgers, PhD, Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and Professor of Psychological Science and Informatics, UCI Co-Director, Child Brain and Development Program, CIFAR, Visiting Professor, Duke University. Did I get all that? It's a lot. So I didn't ask ChatGPT about the big words in this, but what's informatics?
So computer science. So it's essentially putting together a lot of this big data that we get from places like genetics, places, everything we put on our phone, and making sense of that in a way that helps society or can help solve some problems. Information,
And what's the CIFAR?
So that's a call to our Canadian roots. So the Canadian Institutes for Advanced Research, they have a child and brain development program. Actually, one of the other programs is Learning Machines and Brains. So the godfathers of AI, two of the three are actually Canadian and colleagues up there. So that is a fun group to hang out with.
One of them was the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
Last year.
I know. Jeff.
Well, you're very proud of your fellow Canadians.
We are.
Can tell. Yeah. Is it too soon to make the joke? Are you excited?
Yes.
Yeah, way too soon.
Yeah.
It's too soon in my divided household to even say the word Trump. But anyway, okay, well, that's neat. And then we'll get into what's, like I said at the beginning, what's made you famous. You've recently come into some notoriety by taking the opposite approach that...
Yeah, I said something a lot of people don't like. And so I got in a big fight in public. And that seemed to attract some attention. But
Do you mind me asking what that thing was?
Yeah. So... there's been a big accusation that social media is destroying lots of things with mm-hmm. kids. Like, it's destroying their brains, their lives,
their self-esteem,
everything. Like, anything that's wrong with a kid today, people, if you're talking with them at the mall or at a sports thing, it's social media.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out, if you look pretty closely, it's not. It's not social media. So once people hear that information, it's a little shocking, and they get a bit defensive on kind of what else it could be. So I think the problem for the messaging has been it challenges something that people really want to do. You want to hate social media.
Sure.
I also hate social media in lots of ways too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of elements to that. I think a lot of people see the best version of everyone else on social media, you know, and then they can't help but compare, you know, and then, you know, it has this, you know, this disappointing effect when your life might not be as glamorous as everyone else may seem on their social media pages. So I understand, you know, the you know, some of the issues that people may have here. Can you mind me asking, you say very definitively that it's not, instead of it may not be, or
yeah.
maybe we should consider that social media may not be the main cause of this. You seem to be quite definitive about it. Can I ask, you know, why so definitive? Why, you know, what research may have been done, or
yeah.
what, you know, to be so absolutely sure that social media isn't bringing, you know, a negative? I'm not saying, are you saying it's bringing no negative?
So I'll back up a little bit. This gets back to our kid's school, actually. He was a speaker. He came to CDM High School. His name was John Haidt. He wrote the best-selling book that essentially said that smartphones, social media are destroying children's brains, that we have evidence of brain damage, and that it's been responsible for this massive uptick in things like depression, anxiety, suicide, like things that
sure.
are huge, important.
Right.
And so a lot of people believe that, but if you actually look at studies that have followed people over time, and in our lab for the last decade, we've actually been tracking kids on their phone and studying mental health and studying their daily engagement. And the National Academy of Sciences, something that, you know, kind of scientists look at and revere, they convened a panel for a year. They reviewed all of the evidence, and they came out and essentially concluded there's tiny associations. It explains less than 1% of the variation in mental health problems. So that means 99.9% of causes or something else. So that study came out. A bunch of consensus studies came out. A bunch of experimental work came out and was done. And the interesting thing for me was like this massive distance between what everybody believes, what parents, you know, think, or what educators say, or what policymakers do, and what the studies show. And so I'm not saying that there's never an effect for anybody. It's just that this massive narrative that's being put out there is actually misinformation, scaring a ton of people, causing fights within families, causing countries. Australia just banned smartphones and social media for under 16s. And it's all driven by this guy who is not a psychologist, you know, is not a developmental psychologist, who hasn't done any research on it, just selling the story to people.
So it seems to me that it's Haidt. Is it Haidt?
Yeah.
It seems to me Haidt's paper you could substitute anything for social media. You could say anything, cartoons. Or
rock music or yeah. whatever they used to
be. Used video
to
games
porn.
Before that. It was
right,
comic
right, right, right,
books.
Right.
Before that, it was libraries. Libraries were destroying kids, right? Rock and roll was destroying kids.
So, let's just say we could use any of those things in place of social media. What activities are we hoping the kids are doing instead of that? So, say, my kid's in his room doing these things, but I'd rather he was doing X. What is height or his, what is his solution to not doing that thing?
Yeah, I mean, his solutions are fine. There are things that any reasonable person would say. I mean, we all want our kids to be outside more, to play more, to exercise more. Those are all great things. So, you know, many of the things he's suggesting are fine. But this accusation that, you know, social media is causing serious diseases that we know have genetic causes, right, that Tony, you know, could weigh in here, that actually costs, like, have a massive burden of disease that are responsible for more lost, you know, hours work, years of life.
And sorry, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems that you took an approach to narrow the parameters of what he was stating to the point where there's no way he could make a point. Does that make sense? Where
oh, you no, said, you probably haven't met John Height.
Okay. Well, that's what I was just, as I was reading about it, you said there's no credible evidence and or what was it? Was it credible evidence or whatever the word was? But it's kind of one of those things, to me, it seems pretty obvious. Like, don't do too much of that thing, whatever that thing is.
Yeah, and that's
is.
A different argument. There's like a values argument to be made, and parents hate it, right? Like, right. I don't like it. You know, we want our kids to be doing a bunch of other stuff, and that's perfectly fine. Like, we can all agree on that. What I was taking issue with was this idea, you know, he came out and said social media causes suicide, right? Social media causes brain damage in our children.
Well,
like, that is, if you actually look at the neuroimaging stuff,
sure.
Like, it's just not true. Okay, so that was the...
Sorry to interrupt. And I want to get back to this.
Already.
No, I do want to fight you on this stuff because I want to get to what's important to me through you. But I want to introduce Tony and talk a little bit about Tony. And so,
well, maybe I'll ask Candace.
No, I was going to say, you don't have as much stuff with your name.
I don't get to.
Anthony Long, professor in ecology and evolutionary biology. You don't have any of the other stuff. Or is there other stuff that I just couldn't find?
Well, I'm a AAAS fellow. I'm editor of genetics. You know, I guess I don't.
Well, what else? What else?
I think that's about it.
Okay.
That's about it.
Okay. And primarily your focus is with
I work on the genetics of complex traits. So I guess, like, one thing would be a little different from Candace is I'm probably more like where I work or what I work on would be more experimental. So we would do, you know, we're in a field that's more where we can do manipulative experiments, right? So it's a little different academic tradition in some ways. So what excited me about the discussion you were having was that maybe Australia is doing an accidental experiment, right? Where you'd say, like, if social media does cause all this harm, like if some country acts, you know, decides to cut it off, how long before you see
South Korea. They've done it, and it didn't work. So in South Korea, they actually, the government turned it off and turned off video games. They were worried about it.
Yeah.
And there was no effect on anything.
I mean, boy, that's like pretty, for me, that's like, ooh, boy.
You know? And we do, so I have
you
a
You do
clinic,
the experiment, and there's the result.
And I have a clinical trial on this right now, so randomization where you drop it, and there's been randomization. And
well, you
the
get people to
is
sign
zero.
Up for that.
The effect, Tony, is indistinguishable from zero.
Yeah, you might have thought it was small.
Across a meta-analysis of experimental studies. Yeah, yeah. So.
Did they list what they did?
That's the really...
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually,
just to
follow up on Tony, polygenic risk scores, things that we can measure in these kids at birth, actually explains all of the association between social media use and depression. So it's a selection, right? So it's more interesting kind of... Sorry, this is like in the weeds, but...
This is what we're after.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover.
That's where's the crossover?
Yeah. So the genes of social media.
So like if you think about like the hot topic in disease studies now, we talk a lot about personalized medicine. So there's even whole departments being made where, you know, like maybe the treatment for some disease isn't everyone takes drug X. Maybe, like, for some people, drug Y is better, you know? And we think a lot of the idea cooking around is that you know, there's individuals, people are different genetically, and so they might be more prone to different diseases. They might be more akin to different treatments, and that's one of the rationales for doing a lot of the genetics work we do, which Candace actually alluded to, exactly that work.
And so does your DNA and the chromosomes lining up have translated into the brain, that you're looking at brain DNA?
We are not, but I mean, I think because it's, I think the problem's a lot harder. So we tend to, of course, you know, we tend to, you know, the classic thing is the lab scientists carve out easier problems. They get more definitive answers to easier problems, you know, is the hope. But then you think, like, well, geez, like, if why wouldn't social media use with kids be the same? There's some kids that where there's like somehow their genetics line up such that it's really bad. Just like some kids probably shouldn't try cigarettes. Other kids, they could try it and go, yeah, it's not for me, you know.
There's actually this really cool,
but you don't know who.
Yeah, there's this actually really cool idea, which is, it's the analogy is orchids and dandelions. And if you think about, you know, kids, you know, there's a small percentage of the kids in the population that are like orchids, and they have a genetic profile where they're really susceptible to all kinds of things, whether it's substance use, whether it's being pulled in with the wrong crowd, whether it's, you know, difficulty paying attention. And the idea is that those kids need a very specialized kind of greenhouse environment to flourish and to fully flow. And then the other kids are like dandelions. You know, I could drop my daughter off on the street corner and she'd have a great life. Like, she doesn't need me. She doesn't need, but you know, she's a dandelion. And the idea is that a lot of kids are kind of like that, have those dandelion qualities and different. I mean, that's a very simplistic heuristic, but the genetic underpinning of that susceptibility to all these environmental influences is a really kind of fascinating area where I think our research would probably overlap.
Yeah, there's some great examples of where we actually genotype individuals before they take certain drugs to determine if they should take them.
Are you focused on, so let's say we take kids and say, would you categorize adolescents up to 18-year-olds and then adults, so adolescents and then adults?
Yeah, so because all these recent neuroimaging studies have shown that adolescents' brains are still growing up till age 25, adolescence is now from 10 to 25.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember Al Gore famously said he couldn't be held responsible for anything he did before he was 25. Do you remember that? Or was it 20, whatever? And I said, well, he's a genius, so that must give me a free pass until I'm at least 35.
Your brain's still developing,
yeah,
right?
So, well, the reason I think there's a distinction when you get to what you're trying to cure and what you're trying to prevent. And help me, I guess, understand if I was to say, I think all kids, all adolescents are idiots and do stupid things and think like idiots. It's, we're trying to prevent when they become adults that they don't fall off the turnip truck, so to speak. Are we focused on diseases in kids, or are we focused on diseases that emerge once you become an adult? And then in the DNA realm and then in the psychology realm, it seems like it's the most important thing is to save, well, I guess the worst case scenario would be a kid committing suicide, but if we can just get a kid over the hump into being an adult and then keep that adult sane and rational, does that make sense? And because I've had limited experience with circumstances where you have a kid with a normal adolescence and then gets into his 20s or late 20s and just has a major break and can't get off the street for whatever reason. So anyway, I that's a long-winded way of saying, is there overlap to, or what's the focus with when you're talking about adolescence and we say, okay, we don't want these adolescents soaking up so much porn. I'll just call it porn because, say, social media is porn, right? Yeah. We don't want them soaking up so much porn, but we want them doing this, but for this reason, because of when they're an adult. Or is it just so they don't commit suicide when they're an adolescent, so we get them into the... Where am I going with this, and help me understand?
I think you're trying to build a healthy brain, and you want the inputs in those early ages. And so we've known for a really long time that the inputs, whether it's nutritional, whether it's social, whether it's environmental, in those early years, they leave a mark, right? So you can actually detect those. I work on these cohort studies where you start following kids in birth, from birth, and you go follow them into older age. And what you see is a residue of those early life experiences. So you absolutely, what you're saying, Ryan, is you want to make sure that those children have the best kinds of input to be the most resilient when they encounter all these stresses that each one of us are going to encounter in our lives, that is going to push us towards poor mental health that, you know, at some point. Some people think about things like depression as the common cold, like everybody's going to get pushed into that territory at some point, right? And the idea is, you know, how do you make people more resilient to kind of come back sooner, or view it as a kind of a short-term episode.
If you saw a kid, and it's not your kid, you have a kid that you're caring for and they live with you, and they start to show a sign that, let's just say that's, and you fast forward and that kid is on the street, and then you get to rewind and say, okay, this is what I saw. What would be something you would see?
Yeah, so usually with kids that end up in the worst places in adulthood, you see early warning signs. So teachers and parents can start to identify that they're acting out kind of early on in school. And it'll be across different settings. So parents will see it, teachers will see it, friends will see it. So a lot of externalizing behavior. So fights, lying, you know, deception, kind of generally having problems with peers. So those are some early type of warning signs. And then when kids enter adolescence, that's a period where depression, anxiety starts to come in. And it's hard for parents because we're so freaked out about this from, you know, everything we're hearing, that, you know, sadness and feeling down are like actually really normal emotions in adolescence. And so differentiating what's an actual warning sign and what's normal and what's, whoa, we need to get, you know, some help in, we need to get some added support. So that's a tricky balance for parents to think about. And, you know, the biggest thing in, you know, parent-child stuff, as all of you know, is just keeping that communication line open. And, you know, that line where your child can tell you, you know, when it's something other than kind of a normal adolescent ebb and flow. But it looks very different, I think, to Tony's point around kind of personalized medicine. The reason that the field is going in that direction is because we know that there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all kind of cure or intervention, because the causes and consequences of these behaviors vary so much. It's not like a single gene disorder, you know, where we'll be able to target that.
Tony, as I was looking up some of the things that you're working on, I got to a part where you're doing something that is, melanogaster.
That's Drosophila. Oh, yeah, no, that's the flyworm. Yeah.
There was a, something about the chromosomes lining up and the ends of them get longer and shorter. What am I?
That's telomeres, but.
That's
telomeres,
what, that, yeah.
But I don't really work on that.
Yeah,
but
that's,
yeah,
not part of your.
No, but it sounds great.
Well, I was interested, yeah, in that, because that's what I was, yeah, thinking. Is so we so you know what these things are?
Yes.
Telomeres, is that what I'm saying?
Telomeres, yeah, that's the ends of chromosomes. Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially, like, I mean, I've done some studying about the law of attraction and law of vibration, you know, throughout my time, and they talk about lengthening your telomeres,
right,
through all kinds of different ways.
Could, well, you?
I mean, I'm not,
yeah,
sure if you.
And then,
so,
he, I mean,
he said,
really,
he said that's not really what,
no,
part of his,
but
work.
I mean, okay, you know, so you normally, your telomeres get a little shorter with each cell division, right? So that's even a. So if you try to grow cells in culture, they'll peter out after, so human cells. You take primary cells and put them in a really nice environment, they'll divide, right? But only for about, like, I don't know, 30, 40 cell divisions, and then they die. It's called Hayflick's limit. Well studied. He passed away last year. And, the idea is the telomeres are getting shorter and shorter, and then the cells can't divide anymore because the genes start to get deactivated. So whole companies were based on expanding your telomeres. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the problem. One of the hallmarks for a tumor to grow, one of the first things it has to do is switch on the machinery to keep your telomeres getting longer, right?
Interesting.
Because, of course, a tumor would, if a tumor didn't figure out how to keep those telomeres growing, then it couldn't keep dividing. So in fact, we often think it'd be a really good cancer treatment to somehow just make sure you couldn't turn on that machinery, because you have you don't have much of a reason to grow your telomeres, you know, once you're fully developed, it turns out.
Interesting.
All your cells that divide are fine. They don't need to get through that many cell divisions, it turns out.
So,
but not really what I do. You know,
no,
mostly I work on how genes affect complex traits, like, you know, very different model traits. And also we work on how we have a study in mouse. We're looking at what makes them a good or a bad host for the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. And we're trying to find the genetic factors that mediate that. Maybe we could introduce gene drives into wild populations, and then the mice couldn't host the bacteria, and Lyme disease would just disappear in North America. That's one idea.
Did I get it that you're in some way speeding up evolution?
We do that. We also do evolution in the lab to look at how to try to understand how it works. So we actually have microorganisms that we evolve in the lab. It's kind of fun. We have giant robots that transfer yeast populations every day for hundreds or thousands of generations, and then we sequence their genomes over time and watch the changes in allele frequencies to basically test evolutionary models.
So what's a synthetic parent?
So the populations we test we call them synthetic populations. So we basically create populations in the lab and then we evolve them.
So you take a baseline and then evolve it and then study that?
Yeah, we cross several dozen lines together and let them recombine, and then we evolve that and watch what happens. Or we also dissect complex traits in general. So the questions are very general, like for a complex trait, like say, some of these mental disorders or whatever, like what is the genetic architecture generally? Is there generally five or six genes of large effect or hundreds of genes of small effect? And are there more efficient ways to find the causative genes? Like is there kind of ways to get there? So we kind of do that in model systems first to kind of develop methods that would work a little in humans.
We were joking before about your boss and who you report to. So every day, are you getting a little closer and closer to a goal? Do you have a goal or a mission, and you can show results daily?
For sure. Well,
so what's a milestone for you, or what's
all academics would generally get to a point where there's been a significant enough advance that they would publish a paper somewhere.
Okay, so that's
and
that's what you've just accomplished is publishing a paper. So you've achieved that milestone.
A year, presumably,
big paper.
Yeah,
that everybody's talking about.
Right.
So
some papers are talked about more than others. Let's say.
Well, what's your? Have you done a big paper recently? And do you have a big paper coming up?
We're getting close to the end of this big study where we're doing what we call GWAS or genome scans in this mouse host for Lyme's disease, and we're hoping to get some genetic targets that make them a better or worse host.
So if I'm your boss and I say, and I've been on vacation for a month, and I say, Tony, what are we doing? What are you working on? What can you tell me? What have you done that you can show?
Well, usually we
recently
would then point to the papers we're writing, right?
Okay, so you're putting a paper out
always,
once a week,
or you're trying to put together papers and a story to get your next grant to do more research, right? So then ultimately those papers and grants are. So when you submit a grant to the National Institute of Health for funding, there's these panels of about 20 people that a subset of them will read the grant and they'll score it compared to the other grants. Those are other scientists, usually quite good scientists. So, you know, I'm sure Candace has served on these panels, so have I. And they'll kind of rank or score the grants, and then that's how funding decisions are made. So one of the things people value in the U.S. is so-called peer review funding system where these grants are reviewed by your peers, and then the ones that seem to be most likely to kind of be able to figure something out are funded.
So that's kind of a benchmark for success or that you're actually getting the funding.
Yeah, and then you'd hope to turn the funding into papers that ultimately result in, you know, things that benefit society, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is a question I had for both of you, is what's everybody talking about in the world of academia? What's the next big thing? If we were talking about this, say if I asked you this 5 months ago or 5 years ago, what we would say, well, AI is the next big thing. Everybody's working on it, and there's an overlap with AI. Is there something big everybody's talking about now? Or is AI the thing?
So I think even in the past 6 months, AI has become more the thing with these foundational models across, you know, vision networks, genetic networks. Just the pace of discovery is just accelerating beyond what I think people who've worked in these fields for decades had assumed would be possible. I mean, and that's the energy that's happening right now. And with that comes a lot of the kind of cautions and discussions that I'm sure you all have been participating in hearing about. But I think it's figuring out how to work alongside, you know, these advances in ways to take advantage of what the best of what science is doing right now and the best of what technology can do to advance it. You know, whether it's protein folding or whether it's, you know, mapping the mechanisms under a genetic network, or whether in my case it's delivering personalized intervention that really gets who you are, what you need, not just what the population needs for the therapy or for the treatment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think one of the things that's been shocking, and I was surprised or interested to see that you had informatics attached to you, which isn't something I'd think of in your school, you know, but there it is. And certainly it's been a big thing in biology in the last 10 years where the data sets are getting so large and multidimensional that it's really hard for people to efficiently discover patterns using the methods that we've developed. And I would say, and I always tell people, like in genetics, I feel we've learned more in the last 10 years than the field up to that point. I mean, in terms of just the sheer amount of data and stuff that's been figured out.
It's just gotten exponentially larger.
Yeah, but so large, like it's like, I don't know, like you know, I could have I could take like the whole high school my daughter's in and have all the kids come and try to look at little parts of the data, and even then we wouldn't make much progress. So we need we just need ways of thinking about this highly dimensional, highly complex data. And so AI, I don't know if AI is Mary or like something that may or.
Right.
But hope anyway. Yeah,
so you're getting such an influx of data that you're having that you are literally behind on correlating and organizing and understanding it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, just interpreting it. Yeah, wow. So hard. Yeah. Or I don't know if like in a sense there's ways you interpret it and find stuff, and sure you are, but you feel like it seems way richer than what we're pulling out, and if we had just more sophisticated ways of looking at it.
Interesting.
So if you could choose one thing to solve or cure, and this is the question for both of you. So, and maybe it is the same thing. Is it Alzheimer's or what is it? If you had to just focus in on one thing, well, I guess that's a loaded question. I'm going to ask it. If you could choose one thing, regardless of the effort. And then the other one would be is if you could choose one thing because it's easier than other things. So what would be what you're after?
Well, they're not.
If you could choose one thing, regardless of the effort, if you just snap your fingers and it's cured, what is it?
I would choose inequality. The widening inequality in who gets to receive these cures, who gets the money, who gets health, who...
And that was in your paper I read in your paper that was the real cause.
That stratifies everything. Health, opportunity, who you can be in the world, who you think you can be in the world.
Because if I'm feeling melancholy, that, and I don't have anybody to talk to about that or nobody notices it...
It's more if you don't have the opportunity, if you're born into a class. So your postcode you're born into in many countries, especially the United States, determines where you'll end up in life. And if I could change one thing, I would change that.
It's an interesting point because there's an increasing number of treatable diseases we're seeing now, but it's you're looking at the price tag and seeing how's it going to work out. So,
but sorry, that's not a disease. Yeah.
But it's the cause of
disease.
I'd say the biggest cause.
That it turns out it is. Like, yeah.
Right.
It's the biggest predictor of life expectancy, how long you will live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so I was...
Okay, what disease? Is there a mental disorder or a mental disease that just pops into your head?
So for me, it would be depression because it's the biggest global burden of disease, you know, including most physical health problems. In the United States, though, it's different. It would be gun violence. Guns are the number one killer of children in the United States.
Go back to the depression. If the depression, does that lead to something worse, or is depression the thing that's the worst? Is it, if you just live in depression, that's just the worst, but or is there another thing behind depression that... If you knock out depression, you knock out this, this, and this.
Yeah, if you knock out depression, you give back. I mean, depression is connected to physical health, like how people care for them. So it improves physical health. It allows people to go to work. So it helps economic stability. It allows people to parent. So in terms of kids' outcomes, what you asked me about before, the biggest one of the biggest predictors of kids' outcomes is mom's depression and the load we put on moms. Mm. So, you know, this stuff is all tangled up in these really crazy ways. So I would take depression out.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, obviously as a biomedical scientist, it's tempting to go after the big ones, right? Like heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, why not, right? But they're all, the whole system's complex, as Candace is pointing out. So I have my students read in genetics, like there's that now a fairly good treatment coming on for sickle cell disease, which is a disease that affects a lot of African Americans. And it's a gene therapy, so it's pretty interesting genetically. Like, so for, you know, if you're a geneticist, like how they've actually figured out to do it involves CRISPR-Cas9, which is the sexy new molecule, and tweaking genes and that, so it's really
that
cool.
That could narrow that socioeconomic
Yeah, but
gap
I mean, it's
a little
but the cost of this treatment is crazy expensive, right? So right. You say, well, boy, how are we gonna, you know, make that work? Like, even if it is, when you think of curing disease, you'd like to find like cost-effective cures, or otherwise the whole healthcare system just becomes more and more.
So if we were gonna wave a magic wand, maybe depression. We go after depression. Well, we want to narrow the socioeconomic gap, right? But outside of that, depression would be just the worst thing. And then,
geez, I sure like cancer.
Heart disease or heart disease.
Alzheimer's. Sickle cell. Boy, sure like to go after those.
Well, sickle cell. I think you're saying is
that's I'm just saying sickle cell is an horizon. Example of a disease where there looks. Like there might be a fairly effective treatment. So it's been affects, I don't know the number, but tens of thousands of Americans. And, and so then here there is a treatment, and then it's like, how are we gonna actually make it work? How are we gonna deliver it to people?
You know, anecdotally, I'm gonna actually answer that question as well. And I'm gonna say Alzheimer's disease for myself. I took care of my grandmother for 11 years who had Alzheimer's disease, and I watched the progression of that disease from the beginning to the end. And it was one of the most horrific things I've ever seen in my life. And again, it was just me and her in the house for 11 years. I watched it from the beginning when she could walk and talk and cook still for herself, all the way to when she was with a walker and, you know, was having some memory issues, all the way down to when she was in a wheelchair and couldn't remember how to chew her food. And I was fortunate enough that she actually didn't remember my name through all of that. But to see that, like I said, anecdotally, like knowing, you know, having a personal experience with it, I would definitely say that Alzheimer's is one of the most horrific things that a person could go through. And so I would choose that one.
And but say someone develops a pill tomorrow, and it's $1 million a year to take.
Well, I mean, that's another, subject. It's another topic.
That's what I'm trying to learn, some of these terminologies. Are these things chemical, when chemical means DNA? So DNA translates to depression, and depression is a chemical thing. It's all correlated. Do I have this right, or what am I missing? Is depression in the same category as Alzheimer's? And why not? if it's not.
But all these diseases have a fairly large heritable component, meaning that, you know, we think more than 50% of the risk is probably genetically determined, right?
Depression, it could be genetic.
Okay. Certainly has a large genetic component, but there's a large component that isn't genetic as well, right? So it's not completely genetically determined.
External circumstances, obviously, you know, a breakup or whatever, you know, could throw somebody into depression.
Yeah, different things. And many diseases are that way. Although, for example, bipolar disorder has a crazy high genetic determination for some reason, yet we haven't been that successful at finding genes. So, like, one of the old ways to diagnose it was, you know, first degree relative has it.
Yeah.
So that's like already telling you, well, okay, that's probably has a fairly large familial component.
So when we have a choice in the clinic to say, do a genetic assay and track these many genes of small effect, or just do a family tree of who suffered from a mental health illness, the family tree is going to have the predicted value through. So we haven't figured out, even though we have these state-of-the-art assays, even though we can just do hundreds of thousands of markers along the genome, epigenetics, gene-by-gene interaction, we have not crack that code of how this all works together to produce that outcome, even though we know it's like a black box of gene or G by E that's there.
Like our polygenic risk scores for height are about as accurate as knowing the height of someone's both their parents. So it's sort of remarkable, actually. You know, it's like the dirty little secret of current genetics.
Yeah.
Do you mind me asking, Tony, what is your current specialty in genetics right now? What is your current project you're working on and you're actually, like what's your name?
So I work generally on genetics of complex traits, and my kind of claim to fame of note is these things called multi-parent panels or synthetic populations. So I take several highly characterized lines, and we cross them together and intercross them, and then we can do low-pass sequencing of individuals from that population, and we can impute their whole genome at every base pair.
So are you
and
talking?
And then we can do very large genotype phenotype associations. So it's a kind of clever way of dissecting complex traits. So we do that in yeast, in Drosophila. So these are two major model systems, but they're simple. Like Drosophila is a bug, a small fly, and yeast is a single cell eukaryote. And then we also have a mouse system we do it in called Paramyscus, which is like most people, if they saw a Paramyscus, would think it's a house mouse, but it's the house mice and rats are actually native to the old world, and Paramyscus would be the equivalent to a house mouse in North America.
Okay.
But so, they're more like a gerbil.
So what are the applicable, what's the goal to apply your work to society, like big picture? Like, is it like to stop certain genetic diseases from being passed down to their children?
So in the basic systems, the Drosophila and the yeast, it's more just generally understanding these traits.
Gotcha.
So like
basic
why don't polygenic risk scores work? Is there a better way to get at that better way to, you know, slice that onion or whatever, where we can get where we can figure out genetics a little easier, right? In the mouse system, there's a fairly applied problem. So this particular species of mouse is the reservoir for the bacteria called Borrelia burgdorferi, which causes Lyme disease, which is the most, it's the most common insect-borne or arthropod-borne infectious disease in North America, right? 100,000 people a year get the Lyme disease. So we're very interested in how this mouse, so if you go out in nature in the fall and collect these mice, they all are infected with this bacteria. So the tick bites the mouse and then it bites you and then you get Lyme disease, right? So we're interested in a few things. So why the mice all have this bacteria and don't get sick. So they're tweaking their immune system in a way we might be able to learn from.
Right. Or maybe apply that to humans and
somehow manipulate the mice in the wild to make them so they're a crappy host. You know, certainly that's what people are thinking in malaria. If you could go manipulate the mosquito population so they're a bad host for Plasmodium, you could just knock out malaria. And so there's a lot of work being done to try to use this thing called gene drive to kind of manipulate these species in the wild to
make them
poor hosts. So now, that's a big area of research.
Now, I have a question. Forgive my ignorance to the subject, but if you were to be able to figure out, let's say, malaria, you know what I mean? Let's say you're able to, like, figure that out. Would because of the genetic sequencing or the genetic equations that you were able to use, would that be applicable to other diseases like that? Would you be able to use the same formula to find the cures or be able to, or to stop the...
Maybe. Like, so again, like, there's a lot of interest in as opposed to worrying about humans once they get malaria, because we're doing what we can there. One idea would be to kind of knock the host down somehow, so then just less people get it if there's just less of the host, right?
Gotcha. But
less of the species where the actual bug that causes malaria comes from, right? So that's what we're doing with this mouse. We're looking at how come all these mice have this bacteria out in nature, and maybe there's some manipulation that we could knock down, make them less good of a host, so that then, you know, just they're suddenly just like no one would seem to be getting Lyme anymore.
Gotcha.
Right? And so people are really interested in this now because these...
Thanks for clarifying, by the way.
These diseases are coming north because of global climate change, right? So
sure.
We're seeing, like, Zika's coming up into the southern states now, right? Because of their insect hosts are moving north, right? And we seem to think that Lyme might be increasing in frequency in North America because of different reasons somehow. You know, there's more of it kicking around. So there's a lot of interest in these infectious... There remains a lot of interest in infectious disease in general, right?
Thank you. I appreciate you clarifying. Thank you.
Yeah.
Not sure how long... I wanted to do my bit with the...
You're good.
Rate my professor.
Uh-oh.
Have you guys read any of your reviews?
Try not to.
It's one of those things where you like reading, where you're reading the comments online about yourself.
Well, okay, so I had it in my notes that Candace, I was going to say, you're a dean. Why do they call you Mean Dean? Mean Dean Candace.
Because I'm mean.
Professor Mean Dean. And so I have some of your reviews. She's a great instructor, engaging, and can hold the room, but she's not helpful one-on-one.
That's fair.
That, and so it looks like that was a criminology course. And then
in what year? So
2014.
Okay.
So there's actually more to this, and this person mentioned your TA that they didn't like.
Oh.
And I took the TA's name out, but she says she basically passed me off to her TA, but her TA was one of the worst and most useless people I've ever met.
Sounds like a happy student.
She named her, but I took the guy out. And then I guess you were at Duke back then and everybody was missing you.
Could have been a UNC student that transferred over to take the course.
Assigns so much reading. Wordy in her lectures. Must pay attention in class to do well.
But that's criminal.
Keep up with the reading. Awesome professor. One of the best I've had, but not an easy A.
Good.
Interesting class. Lecture is very concise. However, the amount of work required for her class is ridiculous.
These students are clearly making business decisions.
Running them ragged over there.
She is by far the hardest grader I've ever had during my 4-plus years.
Damn.
Detailed and clear lecture. This class is very interesting, but very challenging. Not an easy A. She's very passionate. And then the last one from 2008. So You've been at UCI for a long time.
No, I was at Duke in between, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The way she grades her test is contradictory to the way she tells you to write out your short answers. We were asked to be concise in our answers and give bullet points, then asked to explain as if we were talking to our grandmother. Lots of reading and final is cumulative. Don't take this class. That was C-125.
Wow, that was a decade.
Whatever that one was.
Yeah.
Tony, you actually had a lot more reviews than Candace.
Well,
Candace has few reviews. You have many reviews.
So I teach intragenetics, which is often considered is classically considered a gateway course that,
So it's undergrad.
That can hold students back from what they aspire to be.
So it's like first year chem, where everybody just fails.
Well, we try to not do that, but it will. It does tend to.
It's a weeder class.
It does tend to.
He's very sweet and more passionate and engaging than Thornton. So you had
my co-instructor.
Okay,
yeah. My team taught class.
Okay, let's see.
Looking for
could
the
not
butt.
Stay awake in the lectures for the life of me. Very boring. Just reads the slides. He would give practice quizzes, and the real quiz would have like a third of the questions and the exact same, while the other questions were equally random stuff from the slides. Just study the slides because most of the questions are taken from them directly. That was Bio 97. So a lot of Bio 97. It's hard, but that is a given since genetics is difficult. Overall, he is a friendly professor, but I wish there were more things to be graded in case you bombed one quiz. So you grade your quizzes, you weight your quizzes heavily, it appears.
Yeah, it might have changed, but we, you know, in the big bio courses, we'd have like two big tests would determine the entire grade. So we've tried to go to many small tests now, but because of that. That was a COVID change that affected universities, I think, at a national level.
Well, the kids apparently like you more than they like Thornton, so you have that going
for
you.
We got
to
edit this out. Yeah. Yeah. Bad, we don't.
There was one on here that was good.
I'm sure these are representative.
I've never regretted taking a class so much in my entire life. I originally took this out of sheer interest. But unless you've taken several calc and multiple advanced statistics classes, I would strongly advise against taking this class.
Oh, that's not the intro genetics. That's going to be my
this
upper division
class. This is E137, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, that's my upper division class.
Yeah.
It is called the genetics of complex traits, to be fair.
Well, it says, Professor Long is not too bad, and he's also not too great. His lectures are long and most of the time boring, but he's a really nice guy. So I thought these were, well, there was one on, oh, there's, where is it? There's one where you have an admirer.
Oh.
Oh, here it is. Very easy exams if you put in the study time, but be prepared to be treated like a grad student at office hours. He assumes you know more than you do and sometimes doesn't break it down as much as he should. Love his sense of humor and nerdiness. It's rather cute.
Don't feel too bad, guys. I'm a YouTuber, and I get this
type
of...
Oh, yeah.
So don't...
Feedback.
Don't worry about it. Yeah. Don't read the comments, okay?
This is the first time I've heard them.
Yeah, don't read the comments at all. Like,
well,
I
was trying to determine if I would take your class or not.
Yeah, I know.
So I definitely wouldn't take your class.
Well,
and I don't know about you. It depends on... But the I think the jury's out that... You have to read.
A lot.
You
read.
Yeah, there's a lot of reading things. That goes into your class.
So, I
college.
It's hard.
I said college is hard.
I did a thing on Instagram a while ago where I took like. It was called The Good with the Bad, and I took one good comment and one bad comment, and I put them side by side and posted on Instagram. Here's one of the posts. One of the good one. It says, "You can sing your ass off. Acoustic versions of this song rarely do this song justice, but your vocals definitely do. Good job." Here's the bad one. "I want to punch this guy so hard.
Oh, Lord.
Thanks for the laugh. I'm sure some hippie will love this."
Oh, Lord.
So,
yeah.
So, yeah, The Good with the Bad, my man. Like, don't read the comments, you know?
But you're defending those bad comments. It's good for his soul.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
I still am shocked people actually make comments.
No, you know what's funny is that sometimes when they have a little twinge of truth to
it... I
have a free speech. I mean, go for it.
I love it.
I mean, I actually have written code to filter my inbox when I get into the news because all these guys come after me in my inbox. And now I have my stalker. I have a recent stalker as a Wall Street Journal... If you're listening, a Wall Street Journal reporter who keeps giving me freedom of information requests for like the last 4 years, requesting every email I have written to anyone, going after everyone, all of my students that have published with me.
Whoa.
Going after everyone who sat on a panel with me and hitting them with legal freedom of information acts because he believes, because I believe that mental health is predicted by things like poverty and discrimination and stress and genes and not Instagram, that I'm working for Meta or TikTok or I'm somehow some, like, you do conspiracy stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, he believes that I have to be, like, taking boatloads of money.
He can't just believe that it's your belief.
He
that
can't
you
just
have
believe that I'm someone who spent my entire
you,
life working on kids' mental health.
Own, yeah.
And I think he's full of shit. And that's the reason. So instead, I deal with this guy, like, literally, you know, sending freedom of information requests for the last 4 years through my email.
Do you have to provide
them? And you have to
legally,
provide them.
You're legally
yeah.
have
yeah.
to respond.
Yeah, and you alluded to probably professors being a really good job, but actually a lot of our colleagues have online stalkers because, like,
really?
We do. Well, because, like, again, like, we've published hundreds of papers, and, like, you've
just anyone
you
who
published
disagrees.
A beautiful
yeah.
piece in The Atlantic.
Yeah.
A lot of eyes see that.
Is it always
you
an
publish
opinion,
a big
though,
paper, and someone covers it in the New York Times. And so you'll start to get emails from people who, like, we published a big paper in Nature years ago that was one of our experimental evolution papers. And you could imagine, because it said something about evolution, a lot of people, a lot of, like, religious people were very offended that we were studying evolution
well,
because,
gonna,
of course,
so
it doesn't happen.
Do you come up with theories in yours?
Yeah, of course.
That's it's not just straight science. We've discovered this
yeah.
is this.
Yeah, of course.
It's also hypothesis.
Yeah, and mathematical yeah. models. But at my point, I think it's more general than that. It's just there's just as you like the same thing you saw. You're sticking it out there.
Yeah,
and
I know.
And
yeah.
there's a
you're gonna get a response.
You're,
you know what I mean? Like
out there,
anything
and you have
you
a
put
public
online
persona,
is gonna get a response.
And so
yes.
you're a lightning rod. And,
sure.
And a lot of our colleagues have stalkers for really strange reasons.
Yeah.
Like a quarter or
that's
something.
It,
yeah.
That's
well,
it.
You also teach classes to
sure,
foreign
yeah.
people, and you think of the base rate of some people not being unwell, right? I mean, it is a profession where you encounter just a lot of people, and you
sure.
make decisions that are important to their life and their grades. And
that's why I have no opinions.
Yeah,
zero.
You know,
opinions.
I ran it was like a late night talk show type show on YouTube, 100 episodes, three full seasons, and it was very neutral. I interviewed a lot of musicians and movie makers and stuff, but I still, even from that, just from one or two episodes of, you know, talking, you know, during the lockdowns and stuff like that, somebody started, I got a 2 years.
Yeah, agreed.
I got 2 years
yeah.
stalked. Somebody was calling me in the middle of the night, every night, all from a private number for 2 years
and
straight.
And it's like, how did they key in on that?
Yeah, and why?
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
what,
yeah.
where,
yeah.
what in the world? Like,
I think
yeah.
anyone who sticks it out there on the internet,
anything
or, like,
you say, somebody's
going to
find
document.
A reason.
Yeah.
You know?
Who's that late show talk show guy, Jimmy Kimmel? So Jimmy Kimmel apparently just had a huge effect on the socioeconomic thing that had to do with Obamacare, apparently.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that story? I just started reading about that. Do you know anything about that?
I haven't.
So apparently he had a daughter that had a condition and a pre-existing condition, and so he was in that category. And apparently they were voting the night that his daughter was in the hospital that needed, and he was going to find out if she was going to, you know, if her treatment was going to be paid for or not. And he went on the air and did this thing. Apparently, it just knocked everybody's socks off. But it was all to your point, was that this is a money thing. It's not like a disease thing or anything other than she needs this treatment. She wouldn't be – well, she would be able to afford it, but others wouldn't.
Others the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that
right.
was the point he made. And apparently, he really had an impact.
You know, I think I may have seen that monologue now that you mention it. I think I – now like, – you
yeah,
know, I think I do recall him.
And
I'm not sure. I just remember actually
like
I did see the monologue. I did see him say, vaguely remember that.
But if I were, you know, again, like I'm always saying I'm self-centered and I'm always doing this for me and I'm doing this for me, right? And what I got out of it was what you said. It didn't even occur to me that the real underlying cause of major problems is the gap with socioeconomic issues and those items and the ability to find care, get care, or even be recognized that there could be a problem.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that, and I took something out of that. And then I'm still working on getting something out of you, Tony, was I really thought we were going to be talking about a new lotion to increase your metrines or whatever. What do you call it?
Telomeres.
Your telomeres.
How do you pronounce it?
Telomeres.
Telomeres.
Yeah. Telomere lotion, but okay, apparently it already exists.
Well, then again, if you did, and I you would can, think if there were
your
something that
too
just
long,
in,
apparently,
increased
too.
Your telomeres, it would it might make you more prone to cancer. I mean, like,
yeah,
so it's that. It might be, you know, like, that's what might be a holdup.
We could use their epigenetic clocks and predict their, you know, chronological versus biological age for them.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what the telomeres...
We could tell you?
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the telomeres... Isn't that related to how long you live as well? Like, that's why people were trying to lengthen the telomeres, right? Just so they live longer.
I think that's a claim, but I'm not sure it's been substantial.
That's what you're just talking about.
I understand.
Have you seen Don't Die?
Yeah.
On Netflix?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
It's this guy that, and it's, he's slowed his clock to 60% or something like that.
Through intermittent fasting?
Well, it's through everything. Guys, just watch this show, Don't Die, and it has everything to do with slowing the aging process. And
interesting.
He's a really become popular guy. But, did we solve any world issues? Or the only thing I'm going to be focused, like I said, when I think, genetic disease, and anything, it's the money aspect of it. And if we're going to fix anything, it's to get people treatment rather than make it
an opportunity early in life to live a good life, right? To build a healthy body and brain for kids. I mean, we need to invest. I mean, that's what free school lunches are about. That's about, you know, just supporting. We have so many kids in this country that are just falling right through the cracks. And then you can't expect a healthy adulthood to come out of that. Like, it doesn't add up.
So we should watch out for the Doge group if they're cutting any of these services or circumstances. We should maybe
childhood cancer has taken a hit this
They've
week.
Already whacked it.
Biomedical research has taken a hit. Today, infectious disease, the CDC fired 1,000 people, scientists. Yeah. So I'm not sure that you fire the people who are curing disease first.
So there's going to have to be some sort of reshuffling. I mean, there's no choice. You're going to have to live with whatever these administrative decisions are. You're just going to have to make an adjustment.
Well, I think, Tony, the reason we're here is the United States is the leader in medical research, technology research. It is a shiny example in the world, and that has taken decades of investment from the federal government, from partnerships with universities. It is the envy of the world in terms of science and progress and discovery. And so if we start to tear that apart, you know, I don't know what it means when I get sick. I don't know what it means when my kid gets sick.
But we're always going to be number one. There's not a close second, right?
So, whoa, no.
No, there is a close second. China?
Yeah.
So we want to stay ahead of China in this regard as well. It's why don't we collaborate with them?
We could.
We don't.
We do. We have thousands of Chinese PhD students in the U.S.
I think one of the things, though, that was really sad about the last week in terms of, you know, in addition to the cancer trials being stopped and the cuts that are proposed for biomedical research, it's not just about scientists, it's the entire research infrastructure. So university and medical centers are the largest employers in a lot of states. And a lot of red states, so Alabama, places that I've trained in Virginia, and North Carolina, like those university hospitals, not only do they generate science and the kind of discoveries of the stuff that Tony does or that I do to help people, but they employ the entire community. So I don't know what happens there either. And that community gets served and treated in those hospitals.
Sorry, psychology falls into the biomedical category?
Yeah, sure. So we run clinical trials. Yeah, well, I mean, mental health and physical health, I think for a long time we've realized that the costs of poor mental health, you know, take just as much of a toll in many cases as physical health, so. Mm.
I had a discussion, and you know, with a parent in a sports thing who was a judge, and he was convinced that, like, mental health problems are responsible for probably about half of our total criminal justice system
at least
budget or something like that. It was his estimate just as a judge from the bench. Like, so many, if you solve mental health, like, you know, you suddenly are saving billions a year on prisons and court system, right?
So we've done studies with medical records linking them to, you know, early on, there's 20% of kids that we can identify based on these things you asked me about. And if you follow them through, and we took at the look at the cost of what they cost the economy, social services, the medical system, physical, you know, mental health system, they are responsible for about 85% of the costs, right? That small group of individuals that we just let drop goes on and grows up into adulthood, and that's where the burden of, you know, on society and on those individuals remains. Mm.
But and I'll change the topic too to something that isn't related to NIH stuff, although I'm upset about that. That one of the things I saw was kind of interesting, that when there was some stuff early in the new administration where they were saying, oh, we need like to throw money at the tech companies for to compete in AI nationally, and then this thing came out with the DeepSeek, the Chinese AI thing, and it's like, well, how did they, you know, get close to us, right? Because we're spending all this money on things. And it's like, well, you know, one of the ways they're getting close is they're producing far more kids with computer science degrees in their university. So we have, like, cutting funding to university is like, if you want to compete in the world on tech, you got to train people in tech and graduate them. And the companies aren't doing that. They're letting the universities do it. They're letting kids take out loans to train themselves. And then they're waiting till they know the stuff, and then they might hire them, right? And so, in a sense, the public is investing in training those people, you know, or people have to borrow money to do it themselves, which isn't very efficient. And then we're hoping we can compete with China when they're just like, kids are going for free to college and getting degrees in computer science, and then there's this huge workforce ready to turn the crank, you know. So I think, you know, we do just, you know, I don't want to sound too liberal, but we do have to invest in people in America. And, you know, I think that universities are one vehicle to do that. Not the only vehicle, but one vehicle, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why Apple has its off, like, is located with CMU, right? CMU trains those computer scientists, right? And they just walk across, they're on the same campus, right?
Yeah.
So CMU, what do you mean?
Carnegie Mellon University, so it's a leader in computer science. And so they train the scientists that go on to work for Apple. A lot of the people that work at the, will have cross appointments, and that's the complete pipeline of talent that's coming into Apple.
But the point is, these universities are very closely aligned to tech, and so if we, I think we need to find ways to make college affordable and available to American kids, you know.
What is UCI, tell me if I'm wrong, but UCI is known for its medical department. Is it, what you guys...
For its football team. It's known for its football
team. Yeah, I was going to say, their water polo team.
Yeah.
Volleyball.
Volleyball right now.
They have a great basketball team.
Yeah.
So women won the Big West.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember I saw the game where you guys had that big 7-footer guy. I went to one of the games.
So UCI's top 50 public in the U.S.?
But
the statistic.
You had when I was in high school, excuse me, there was something happened with embryos and eggs and
that's the whole California. Yeah.
What I'm getting at is that what UCI is known for?
No.
What's UCI known for? What's the UCI's
I'd say it's just a good in general. I mean, we're top 50 public. One of the things that was interesting, Obama came and gave the commencement speech some years, about a decade ago.
Oh, I didn't know
that. And one of the things we learned coming up to that was that UCI has more Pell-eligible students than the entire Ivy League combined. So that's pretty interesting, because Pell-eligible students are this group of kids that can go from the bottom 25 percentile in terms of income to the top 25%, right? Huh. So that's like a kind of what we call a social escalator or mover, and UCI is very well known for that. I mean, because that's a remarkable. So there's a lot of opportunity there, and I think the University of California in general, right, is a big big engine, a lot of students that were getting are getting degrees in.
For what in, though? What getting degrees in what? What's
Oh, biology, psychology,
yeah, engineering, computer science,
and
engineering.
So it's hard. It's all sciences. Yeah, all sciences.
But every, I'd say not just. I mean, I think in general. I mean, I think if you're going to be a top 50 university in the country, or it's top 50 in the country, top 10 public, right? So that's if you're going to be that, you probably have to be good at a lot of things, right? So you know, it's pretty good, pretty solid,
pretty broad.
Yeah, sure.
I can't think of a better place to send my kids. I just think there's not a better place you could send your kids than UCI. I mean, I'd rather visit and watch a football game, of course, but just the general location and the surrounding territory, and I can't think of a better place.
Well, I started my career at UCI in 2007. I was here for 5 years. I went to Duke, and I was at Duke for 5 years. And when we were looking to move, I came back to UCI. I loved it as a place. I thought it was very entrepreneurial. There was kind of a great and growing tech scene in the area and a lot of room to grow. It's one of the UC campuses that actually has land still to grow and build. And so a lot of kind of, there's a new health sciences center that's gone up, a couple new hospitals have been added. So it's really got this energy of kind of growing and building.
Was it tough leaving the basketball mecca of the university?
Oh my God. Yeah. Cameron Stadium. My heart, I left my heart there, but yeah, I am here.
You're a coach now. Who do you coach now?
I coach my 11-year-old daughter.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Okay. All right. At what?
Their fierce basketball.
Very cool. Yeah.
Pretty cool. Well, what do you think? I think we ran over our time.
That's fame, man. I think it was a great conversation today. Thank you so much, Candace. Thank you so much, Tony, for joining us today. This has been really fantastic. And thanks, Ryan, for putting this all together, brother.
I'm really thankful you guys had enough faith in me to waste your time and come see me. And is there anything you wanted to add? Any crossovers that we missed or anything? Because otherwise...
Any plugs you'd like to make? Any papers you want people to read or social media pages you'd like people to go check out?
No, but if people are considering college, it's probably important to read.
To be a reader?
To be right. Not read my evaluations, but actually read.
I would say that a lot of professors will ask you to read material from time to time.
And I actually am pretty good one-on-one.
So you were listening to the reviews. It's the first. I can't imagine being a student and actually taking the time to fill out the review form.
You'll notice that only one out of 200 students. Right. So it's either the ones that really love us or really hate us. Get on there, yeah.
And that's another thing I've always thought was it must be fun or funny sometimes when you – get a student that's called a know-it-all or somebody that thinks they're more advanced than they really are, or and they haven't had, I always say the way to get wisdom is through experience, and you get experience through bad decisions. So that's why I always think these little kid students coming to you with a critique or who do they think they are, they don't have the wisdom.
I think, you know, if they're coming to you, you listen. I mean, I think the problem now a lot of times with students is they're not coming through the door. So I think if you're coming through the door and you're coming with a bad idea, a good idea, you know, an arrogant idea,
let's talk about it. Love,
I think most professors are just hoping for engagement, period.
So if you were to give advice to any student, it would be show up for office hours. Tell me if I'm wrong. That would be, I always say, sit in the front of the class, sit in the front and the middle, and then just show up for office hours every once in a while. Would you say that would increase your grade automatically? You get at least go from a B minus to a B?
Yeah, that I think for your students that are really keen, you know, come find Tony, come find me. We train undergraduates, train them in our labs, you know, get to actually do the research, make it come to life. And those are the kinds of experiences in, you know, university that can really kind of put you on this path to, if for a love of science.
Yeah, my son goes to UC, and I the one thing I encourage them to do is this, what we call the Bio 199. It's not a bio student, but the idea of like doing one-on-one research with a professor. I think it's what really sets the UC apart from a lot of universities. I mean, a lot of universities offer it, but we're good at it. And it's
so a kid
it
just
totally
hits you up, even if
experience.
He's not taking your class. He just walks in and says, "Hey, I'd like to I'd like you to put me in your back pocket."
Well, it's a conversation about like what kind of commitment. So we'd say like, this is the kind of commitment we ask of you in our lab or our team. You know, are you able to do that? And then you look at kind of some of the things they're doing if you think they're ready for that kind of engagement. And
but then does that kid end up paying for your course or taking your course, or do you just take that kid on as a?
Sometimes you end up paying them, right? As if they're good, they'll get a paid research internship in the summer.
Summer
if they're,
gigs.
Yeah.
So then that's. Something that now that's something I wouldn't have guessed is you can be a student at any university and choose a professor you like and then just go hit them up and they could become your mentor. It's likely that they would because
if
you show that interest, if you take the initiative.
Interesting.
Yeah, and we
that's really
our
cool.
Team,
I didn't know
so
that.
We have like postdocs or people who have a PhD and are almost faculty, graduate students, and then undergrads, and they're all working kind of in the lab and on projects. And so an undergrad could come in, and they would have near peers, you know, a kind of group to work with, and then also have a professor and various people around them. So it's a great way to get research experience.
Yeah, you have the opportunity to break a piece of equipment worth $50,000 every day.
You can scan your own brain if nobody's in the lab that day. Like it's all the things.
That's
you
pretty
can
cool.
Draw your own blood.
Yeah, that's
get your
cool.
immune function.
PCR your DNA sequence it on the side.
You know, hang out with
that's
the cool.
Great
with
news,
the mice.
Eddie. You're a genius. Yeah. You've been a genius for the last 45
come on,
years.
Man.
What are you going to do now?
That's fantastic. Actually, that's really interesting. And I have a question for you guys. Would you say that most professors are like that and want that kind of engagement from their students?
Yeah.
Or are you just speaking for yourselves generally?
No, that's why we do it.
Yeah.
You think most professors
welcome
me one-on-one?
We love sharing it, right?
Teaching
it.
That kind of engagement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I remember because, you know, when I went to college, I didn't feel that, you know. I went specifically for music. I mean, so I was you know, in, you know, generally music classes for 2 years straight. But, yeah, I didn't feel that from my professor. I didn't feel like a whole, like, you know, welcoming vibe and like, hey, come, you know, come to the door. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't get that, you know. But hey, you know.
Have you ever heard the name Richard Offshey, Dr. Richard Offshey? So now, I'm guessing there's a lot of overlap with psychology and psychiatry.
Some, yeah. They're in the med school.
Okay. Yeah. Now this guy, he was a professor at Berkeley, and he was very popular. Everybody wanted to take his course because the very first thing out of his mouth or the first lecture was how to deal with a cop. And it was really interesting. He was apparently the first guy called in for Waco. So the FBI gets to the scene at Waco and they said, get Dr. Offshey here. Well, this guy, Dr. Offshey, drove a red Ferrari to, you know, around campus and things. He's a popular guy. Well, anyway, his thing was, you say nothing other than I want my I'm saying you say nothing other than I'm saying nothing. I want my lawyer. That was his whole thing. But anyway, it was very, and there was serious overlap with him and because he got into the DNA stuff and the psych. So there was one course with him for you guys. But it was interesting that they wanted to do a profile immediately on, what was the guy's name?
Koresh. David Koresh?
Yeah. And they actually flew the guy out there. Do you ever get anything like that? Any, like, hot CSI? We need
so
Dr.
I started,
Rogers immediately.
Yeah, I started my career interviewing kids in prisons who committed really kind of awful crimes. Yeah, so that was my first job. But yeah.
What about you? They ever?
No.
The FBI doesn't call you to the scene.
A colleague I had, you know, who was an expert witness for, you know, DNA and criminal trials, several. They always were interesting. They'd get those calls, and they'd get like fan mails from prison, like people that like, of course, because no one in prison is guilty, right? So they'd all be writing letters like, you can just get me out right. If you
so who knew to become a hot professor you get stalkers and fan mail.
Yeah.
From prison.
Become a
you guys are rock
consultants
stars.
For the FBI.
See, I told you this was a good idea. We'd like to thank our producers and
absolutely
for sponsoring us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like and again, thank you guys so much for coming today. You know, it was a fantastic conversation. I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you for having
me. Now we get credibility and we can throw your names on our research work now.
I really do have like so many more questions, you know, anytime we come back. Next time when we come back, you know, I'll get a little deeper into some of the stuff, some of the questions we have, you know. So we'd love to have you sometime.
We could bring a criminal and put the criminal on the couch.
I mean, yeah. We know enough of those. We can figure it out.
I'm just going to go lay down on the couch. Can we just do a whole other episode right now with me on the couch?
All right, you guys. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Thank you, Ryan. You have anything to end with?
Class dismissed.
See you next time on Weird Connections, guys.